Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, and today we're talking to Sean Guillory of Sean's Russia blog. And we'll be talking about misconceptions of contemporary Russia and perhaps left-wing misconceptions of the Soviet Union and the intersection between the two today. So the topic's somewhat broad and maybe somewhat unwieldy, but it's necessary to really get a grasp on contemporary geopolitics. So let's start off with a kind of basic primer. What do you think is causing today's renewed Russia phobia?
I think it's rooted in just the inability to come to terms with the fact that Trump got elected. I think the Trump election is a trauma. And I say it's a trauma because we repeatedly have relived it and litigated it and tried to figure out how it happened. And there's various arguments. And Russia, you know, functions because of the interference of, you know, Russian internet stuff, the hacking. It is a convenient thing to place Trump in league or as an agent to Russia, or the Russians wanted to elect him, because then we can say that Trump doesn't come from us, that he's some sort of outside alien infection. He doesn't represent the America that we thought we were in under 8 years of Obama, that was progressing towards a kind of, you know, more liberal, more tolerant, more inclusive society. And I think that Trump's election, against all odds, is conveniently explained in a kind of form of displacement by saying, oh, it's because of the Russians. It's not because of the failures of the other candidate. It's not because the America we thought existed actually doesn't exist. So I think that and Russia has played this role repeatedly in the 20th century for the United States. So it's kind of, you know, going back to a Cold War villain to explain what has happened.
Do you think that tradition of demonizing Russia actually maybe even goes back to before the Cold War?
Not so much. Well, the history of Russophobia in the United States, and I want to define what I mean by Russophobia first, and that is when Russia is positioned as a civilizational threat to the West, and in quotes, or to the United States, or to our values or our democratic institutions. So when Russia is placed as this existential threat or civilizational threat, this is what I define as Russophobia. The history of Russophobia in the United States is very late, emerges very late when compared to, say, in Europe, like in France or in Britain, which it has a much longer history. Russia started to appear as a threat or even an infection on Western civilization or American civilization in the 1880s, after some of the first pogroms, as the result of, particularly in 1881, after the assassination of Alexander II. And the United States started to get a lot of Jewish immigration as a result of the violence and anti-Semitism against Jews in the Russian Empire. And by the 1890s, Russia is being used as a means to say, you know, look how barbaric they are. Look at the violence that is being perpetrated against Jews. The United States under Teddy Roosevelt even presented a petition to the Tsar to liberate Russian Jews in the Russian Empire. And it's interesting that Russia takes on this role at that very point, because on the one hand, the United States is now more engaged with East Asia in terms of its imperial ambitions. And it's also one of the most racially violent periods of American history, as well as a period in which there's a lot of labor struggle, there's a lot of labor violence, and, you know, a radical movement brewing in the 1890s in the United States. So again, Russia plays as like, well, we have all of these troubles, but look over there what they're doing.
Yeah, so to me, what's interesting about this current Russophobia is it does seem to be somewhat continuous with the Cold War, but it's also almost guilty of doublethink. Because on one hand, you'll see even fairly liberal sources like, say, Rachel Maddow describe Russia as continuous with the Soviet Union, and yet they'll also talk about it being uniquely reactionary.
Like, yes.
How do you think that can be held in one's head, and what do you think they thought, like, these sources, I mean, in a way I'm asking you to do psychoanalysis, is not fair, but what do you think a lot of these sources seem to think the Soviet Union was? Because it seems like they can't have a very coherent notion if they think Putin's Russia is the USSR. Right.
No, not at all. And I think that's one of the problems that Russia poses for a lot of us who look at it and try to understand it, you know, on its own terms, but also recognize that it is a modern capitalist society. So one way to look at that is to say, okay, Putin's Russia, because of his kind of muscular foreign policy, because of the authoritarianism in the country, because of, you know, he's a KGB, you know, career KGB agent in the Soviet Union, whatever it may be. This is the Soviet Union reborn, right? So, you know, the all the emblems have changed, you know, but it's still kind of in essence that same old bad Russia from the Cold War. The other problem is that a failure to say, okay, Russia is capitalist, but because it's not, you know, a liberal democratic state, because of its authoritarianism, because of its kleptocracy and corruption, it's a malformed capitalist state, right? If it only adopted the values and institutions of, say, the United States, then it would be a proper capitalist state. So even then, you know, by making Russian capitalism into a kind of mutation, on the one hand, you're saving Western capitalism, right, the proper capitalism, but also showing Russia as this kind of continually backward society, that if only they became like us, then things would be much better for them. And this is one of the problems, I think, too, and how what Russia, I think the image of Russia functions in political discourse in the United States and to some extent in Europe as a way to reconstitute American or Western values by posing Russia as other or as a threat. At the very moment, the values and institutions that underlie in the economic system that underlie liberal democracy in the so-called West, by posing Russia as other, we can reconstitute those values and the unity of those values within ourselves. So that's kind of, I think, one of the another function that Russia plays, particularly for liberals.
Yeah, right. Because I was thinking about that in the way that Russia is used differently than, say, China for the same reason. In liberal discourse, it takes a very particular flavor that you wouldn't see with China, partly because I think people would notice some racial animus there that would make people uncomfortable, and partly because there seems to be a liberal bias towards China in some ways, even though I'm not quite sure why.
I think the racial thing is actually really important, because Russians, by all intents and purposes, look white, right? Yeah, but they're kind of
Russia.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, if you've ever been to Russia, you'll notice that it's a multi-ethnic society. But whatever, the idea is they kind of look like us, and they have and within that resemblance, I think there's a certain desire for, like, them to become like us, like they have potential. Whereas in China, well, you could say, you know, even subconsciously, well, they're Chinese, they're not white, right? So we can get, I think there's some slack cut for the racial other in this sense. Whereas for Russians, you know, they, Slavic people look kind of like us, they can become like us, they have that racial potential. But the fact that they just keep failing, I think also is a way to reinscribe that backwardness in, say, Slavic peoples. And I mean, as some Russian friends have told me in response to all of this Russia gate, Russia hysteria in the United States, is that it seems to them Russians are the only legitimate ethnic other that you can be racist against, is the way they see it. Though racist, of course, is, I think, a wrong term in this sense, but you get the drift.
Right. I mean, if we were being really technical, we'd say ethnicist, but yeah.
Yeah, ethnicist, which, yes.
But yeah, I get that. And so I'm going to use a kind of ridiculous example to get us to get us maybe to some not so ridiculous questions. Jonathan Chait, I guess. You sighed immediately. you probably know what I'm going on. Wrote this long piece for New York Mag's Daily Intelligencer that basically posits something like a conspiracy theory that Trump has been in, quote, Russian pockets all the way back to 1987.
Yeah.
You sighed because you know this. But what I was struck by reading this, the assumed continuity between Gorbachev's Soviet Union And the current Russian state was a little bit baffling, because I don't even know that the Russian state's continuous to itself, even back to the mid-90s, in a way that is so clean. So
yeah.
What do you make of the substance of that sort of thing? I mean, can we just cast that out of hand?
I think it's pretty ridiculous. And that Chait article, which I think was published like 2 months ago now, yeah. I think it was like the third iteration of this argument that has been posited, that Trump's visit to the Soviet Union in 1985 or in 1986 was the origin point of him becoming a Manchurian candidate. And I mean, this is just ridiculous. I don't know what else to say about it, because first off, it does suppose a certain continuity within those institutions, that there wasn't a revolution in Russia in 1991, that there wasn't a major transfer of power, a dismantling of Soviet institutions, a breakup of the security services, not only the fact that a lot of security people, you know, were moonlighting doing other jobs with organized crime and things like this. Like the former secret police is not the same secret police today. I mean, there's certainly some holdovers, but to have any kind of operational consistency is just, I mean, I don't even understand where this is coming from, except to say that, you know, again, it's Russia for Americans can often play an imaginary place, and it serves as a very good villain, particularly of those of a certain generation like myself, who, you know, of course, grew up on a lot of these Cold War films where Russia as the villain played a much more heroic struggle than, say, terrorists do, right? Because, like, again, because Russians are modern, quasi-white, they are a legitimate foe. And therefore, psychologically, I think they do play a better villain than, say, you know, the Islamists in Afghanistan or the Taliban, right?
So when you look at this, particularly with this projection, I was also thinking, though, there's a kind of mirror image among certain elements of the far left in the UK and America and the English speaking world. And admittedly, when we say this, we're talking about a coterie of maybe a few hundred people. And even if you were dipping into the DSA, you're only looking at, you know, a couple of thousand.
Mm-hmm.
But where this image of Russia is flipped.
Yes.
So, and there was a time when this was actually sort of gaining popularity, even in liberal circles, when like everybody loved Russia Today,
mm-hmm.
where they saw where people portrayed Russia as kind of an anti-imperialist bulwark against NATO.
Yeah.
you laugh at that. So, so what do you think that this reading misunderstands?
Well, I mean, first off, it continues to portray. Well, I'll say this first. One of the unfortunate things that for the present day left is really an ignorance when it comes to a lot of geopolitical issues. There's a lot of foreign issues that, say, and I'll speak of the American left, that they're very, very tied up in and feel passionate about, but don't really have, for the most part, a good grasp of the complexities of some of these geopolitical questions as they exist, you know, over there. And unfortunately, Russia falls into one of those. And seeing Russia as a kind of negation of American unilateralism or a negation of American hegemony or NATO, et cetera, is basic. To see that is to reproduce a binaried worldview that doesn't exist anymore. It's to reproduce a Cold War binary that doesn't really conform to present day geopolitics. It would be better if leftists think about today's geopolitical configurations more in terms of the 19th century than the 20th, which, you know, the Cold War binary of two superpowers facing off and then also waging various proxy wars is an anomaly in the history of geopolitics. The norm is a multi-centered, multipolar world in a variety of different ways. And I think we are definitely emerging. We've come to a fore where you do have a multipolar world that consists of the United States, Russia, China, India, you know, Japan, Turkey to some extent, Iran, where you have great powers. Some of them are regional, some of them are global, but you don't have the the unipolar world you had after 1991. You certainly don't have the binaried world you had between 1945 and to 1991.
Yeah. So to dig in that a little bit, I've been thinking about why I have quit hearing so much about the BRICS. So for people who don't know what that is, that's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and
Singapore.
Okay. Always forget that S. Why has that sort of disappeared into discourse in the English speaking world? And do you know if it's still heavily part of the discourse in Russia?
I'll start with the last part. The Russians' assertion and their more aggressive or muscular foreign policy is an attempt to facilitate that multipolarity, because Russian foreign policy is not based on alliances, right? They have, and this is repeated in a lot of liberal commentators who are, you know Russia really well. You know, Russia has no allies. Well, they don't want any allies. They like to make particular deals, and they like to come together with other powers based on mutual interests or shared concerns. So, for example, if you see the Russians operating in Syria, I think it's a really good example of this, where the Russians are talking to Turkey, Iran, and Israel. The idea in the American mind that a power can talk to both Israel and Iran just doesn't make any sense in many respects. So this is, the Russians operate this way. They like to say, okay, yeah, we're not friends, we're not allies, but we have an issue, we have interests, and we're going to try to hammer them out. I mean, I think, you know, the deal that the Russians hammered out with Turkey over Idlib, I mean, it remains to be seen what will actually happen there. But I think it's a good example of the foreign policy, the way they go about it, as compared to, say, in the United States, which is very binaried. I lost my train of thought on the other part. Sorry.
So with Russia's kind of multipolarity and as you were stating, its immediate foreign aims is really is to just create a stable sphere of influence. Where would you say they want that sphere of influence to be? I heard you talk about this in another interview for The Dig. In some detail, so you don't have to go into as much here, but how would like a political planner and United Russia think about what Russia's sphere should be?
It would waver between a very interference in its borderlands with its bordering states. So, for example, take Ukraine, the backing of, say, Yanukovych in 2004. For example, or the backing of Yanukovych in 2010, and then also, you know, allowing him to flee to Russia in 2014. So the hard aggressive line would be to push border states ideally to a more pro-Russia stance. The softer line of that foreign policy would be, we want ideally neutrality. So we want, say, like a Finlandization of Ukraine. So you can see this, for example, in the different responses of the Russian government to, say, the Maidan Revolution in 2013, 14, and the recent revolution, or whatever one is calling it, in Armenia, and about 6 months or so ago. The Armenians were really smart in going directly to Moscow and saying, look, this is not about you. And they didn't take a posture towards Europe. They didn't take a posture towards West. And the Russians seem to be okay with that. Whereas, say, in Ukraine, which granted, Ukraine has a very, very large border with Russia, were posturing to the West, you know, eventually joining the EU, of aspirations to join NATO, and also the aspirations of NATO in the Bucharest Declaration in, now I'm missing the date, I think is 2008, to eventually include Ukraine into a European architecture. So, you know, the softer line there is that, okay, Ukraine has to be neutral. It can't be, you know, it certainly can't be part of the West, but I think the Russians would be happy if they're not just hostile either.
So this brings me to something that's a little bit more complicated, and that is this idea of the Soviet Union as A, being contiguous with Russia. To what degree is there any validity to a sort of continuity between the Soviet Union and like the Russian Federation or the contemporary Russian state?
Well, I mean, it's been 25 years, you know, a lot has changed. Russia no longer has the institutional, political, or economic structure of the Soviet Union. You know, if you're in Moscow or any other big city, you still see a lot of Soviet symbolism, lots of statues to Lenin. You know, Lenin's still kind of mummified in Red Square. There still is, because of the older generation who grew up most of their life in the Soviet system, there's nostalgia, there's memory. You know, all of the Soviet films are played on TV still. There's a reappreciation of Soviet culture to some extent, particularly as Russian popular culture today doesn't seem to have the same level of sophistication or culturedness as Soviet culture. There's a certain nostalgia for Soviet education system. So if there's any vestiges of it, it's more, in my conversations with people, a sense of loss, a loss of those memories, the sense of stability in, say, the 1970s. I mean, all of it, of course, it's memory, right? It's not actually how people lived. It's how people lived are more complicated than that. But there is a sense of a loss of the ethic of the Soviet Union, the promise of it, of like friendship of peoples, equality, et cetera, et cetera. But that's it. I mean, Russia today is not the Soviet Union in any shape or form, except for rhetoric, except for symbolism and things like this.
So one of the things I find most fascinating about listening to your show is you are probably one of the few people who kind of explained to me the complicated disaggregation of the Soviet economy in mm-hmm. the late 80s, because I really had no clue how, other than the gulag mobs, you know, the Russian mafia, how these like fully formed capitalist infrastructures came to being, not easily, but fairly quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about it, it was much quicker than you could have predicted. And when I remember you were, I forget who you were speaking to, but you were talking about both the way that organized crime fits mm-hmm. into that, but also the way that the co-op kind of folded into that. Why do you think that's so understudied, even amongst, you know, socialists?
you mean the co-op part?
Yeah, the co-op part. I never hear anyone talk about that at all. Like, people talk about the mob part, but not the co-op
right.
part.
Yeah, it's in Russia, it's called komsomol capitalism. Mm-hmm. So it's the because, and it's actually fascinating. I was just commenting to a Russian friend on social media about a week ago about, if anyone wants to actually study these Komsomol, Young Communist League cooperatives, the documents, as far as I know, are open and available. When I was working in the Komsomol archive in the late 2000s, all of those documents were open and could be studied by people. I don't understand why it hasn't gotten all of attention. But what was it? Well, essentially, the Soviet system periodically did experiments with certain other forms of the economy. And one of those experiments under Gorbachev was to allow the Young Communist League they had these technical centers, which basically were like these scientific innovation centers where young people who were interested in computers and science could get together and, you know, learn computers and things, build computers, stuff like this. Well, what they started to do to, say, build computers, they had to get a lot of parts and computer components through Eastern Europe from the West. And so a lot of them were really self-taught. But when Gorbachev legalized cooperatives, this allowed for some of these Komsomol-based economic enterprises to really take off and allow them to become, you know, really profitable economic units. And, you know, Mikhail Khodorkovsky famously came out of this. And basically what it did is it flooded some of these Komsomol entrepreneurs like Khodorkovsky with a lot of cash. And that cash allowed them to establish banks. And once they had banks in the late, you know, 1990, late 80s, 1990, and then finally into the collapse, they're the only ones that have the financial capital to take advantage of the privatization of the Soviet economy. So if you look at the structure of where a lot of these, you know, oligarchs from the 1990s come from, they actually come from, first off, fairly Soviet elite backgrounds, right? They come from either the Soviet intelligentsia, they come from the Soviet technical elite, or even some of the party elite, but they're the younger generation that is able to adapt really quickly to the changing times and take advantage of things. And, you know, people like Khodorkovsky, this is where they got their start.
How does that intersect with the more well-known organized crime part of the establishment of capitalism in modern Russia?
It begins to intersect because, you know, you're dealing with a very primitive accumulation of capital in the early 1990s. Organized crime is able to step into the vacuum left by the state in terms of the monopolization of force. So mafia organizations play a dual role. On the one hand, they provide protection, you know, they run protection rackets in addition to their own kind of economic, whatever, transactions and things like this. But also they are important for facilitating distribution of goods through various networks. So the early stages of the development of Russian capitalism really come through in what there's a great book by, I want to say his name is, I know his last name is Volkov. I think it's Vadim Volkov, called Violent Entrepreneurs. And it's about this intersection between organized crime and not just organized, like really hardcore mafia structure, but, you know, gangs, things like this, anybody who could provide protection, and businessmen, up and coming businessmen in the early 1990s.
So what fascinates me about that is there's a certain narrative out of some left communist as well as Trotskyist that had already posited that the industrialization of Russia was its own form of capitalism.
Sure.
And if that was the case, then I have a hard time seeing the need for either the mafia or the co-ops to have gone the way they've gone. However... if you look at someone like the Trotskyist Tony Cliff, who this was why they opposed the USSR, is there any part of that narrative that is kind of true?
In terms of state capitalism?
Yeah, in terms of state capitalism. Like, in what ways were there capitalist-like structures in Russia? And then that actually brings me to another thing that I have been puzzling out for years and don't have a good answer to.
Sure. Well, if I understand their analysis correctly, they're essentially saying that Russia is state capitalist, right?
Right.
So basically, instead of having entrepreneurs or businessmen or a bourgeois owning class, you basically have the state. And I think the essence of their critique is that you don't have socialism because you still have a relationship between capital or state capital and labor, where you were exploited labor and workers don't have a right to, you know, organize independently, or they don't have a political voice, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
You know, there are elements of that, I think, particularly during the Stalin period, during the big push for industrialization, where that is absolutely true to a large extent. I mean, when you know, in the early 1930s or even the first 2 5-year plans, I mean, they really are squeezing labor hard. And there's all sorts of punitive actions to, you know, against absenteeism, but they're also in a situation where labor is very fluid. There's a demand. There's such a demand for industrial labor that workers have a lot of freedom to just kind of, you know, screw this enterprise, I'll go get a job at another one. But later on, once the Soviet system gets more and more embedded, that becomes a little bit more murky, because the thing that industrial enterprises that supply in the Soviet system is really interesting, because they are not only a place of employment, they're also the center of a lot of community and urban relations, in the sense of the factory is providing hot water and heat. The factory, through trade unions, owns resorts and are facilitating vacations. A lot of the worker benefits are in kind. So workers are certainly receiving fairly low salaries, but some of that is being compensated for a whole bunch of other privileges and access to certain goods and services. Now, this is not to say that there isn't exploitation. There absolutely is. But I wouldn't put it I think state capitalism doesn't account for this other relationship. It's better to see it more as almost a corporatist or paternalistic relationship.
Are you familiar with Hillel Tikhon?
No.
He was an economist, a Marxist from South Africa, and he really headed up this idea of bureaucratic collectivism. And his critique of the USSR was that it was bureaucratic collectivist and also thus really massively inefficient. Do you, in your study, and this may be beyond your purview, but do you know how actually inefficient the USSR was?
It was incredibly inefficient.
Okay.
Incredibly inefficient. Because just to give an example, and I'll give an example for agriculture. So you have a collective farm in a region of Russia. The planning of, say, the how much wheat or whatever crops you're supposed to grow, the harvest quotas, these things are all planned in Moscow. So how is somebody in Moscow supposed to know the particular local conditions of farms out, 1,000 miles away? You know, Khrushchev tried to change this a bit, but, you know, going to this idea of bureaucratic collectivism, he was ousted by a bureaucratic elite in many respects. I mean, they quickly soured on him because of him trying to disrupt the inefficiencies and bureaucratism of the Soviet economy. So the effort to plan the entire economy, I mean, really down to the screw, required a certain level of entrepreneurialism on the part of, say, factory directors, where if you needed parts and you couldn't get them from whatever the planning agency, allocated for them, you had to make side deals with other enterprises. So there's actually a sub-history that I think deserves far more attention. Already in the 1930s, this is going on under the first five-year plan, where there's certain entrepreneurial activities that are going on within the planned economy just to try to get around the bureaucratic bottlenecks.
So this kind of brings me, I feel like we're working backwards in time here, but this kind of brings me to an interesting point. What do you think people in the States, and I'm not going to limit it to one political tendency right now, get the most wrong about Russia under Stalin?
That it was totalitarian, in the sense of that the central government had control over all aspects of life.
In what ways was it not totalitarian?
It was a, now I'll state that it certainly aspired to that, but in reality, it worked differently because the Soviet Union, and I think you can extend that all the way up to Russia today, is a very undergoverned society where the institutions of governance are actually quite fragmented and are very even more so in the 1930s, where in some regions you have no Communist Party presence. You're lucky if you have young communists like Komsomol members are the face of the regime in some localities. You know, communications are very broken. It takes weeks to get the mail. You're dealing with an administrative class where the education levels are incredibly low. I mean, you're lucky that they're literate. You're dealing with directives being constantly sent from the center down to the lower organs, where the lower organs have to interpret how to carry out those policies. You know, sometimes they're just ignored. Sometimes because of the ideological tensions, particularly after, 1928 in the early 30s, they're caught between Soviet officials on the local level are caught on the one hand between if they go too hard on a policy, they get criticized for being a leftist. If they go too soft on a policy, they're being criticized for being a rightist. And as a result, it produces a context in which in order for them to survive politically, let alone physically, they have to lie to the center on their production quotas, lie onto the center about the activities they're carrying out. And so the communication between the periphery and the center is very broken. And the center is constantly trying to utilize very, very different mechanisms, the police, the media, the party structure, letters from citizens to try to gauge the mentality of try to get information about what's going on. Like I'm teaching a class on Stalinism right now. And one of the things I continually tell my students is Stalin is dependent upon what he can see. So what information is he getting from, say, police organs out in the middle of nowhere who have bureaucratic interests in pumping up the existence of enemies and all sorts of suspicious characters? So this is not to say that the state was violent. It was very, very violent. But violence, in my view, is because of the fragmentation of governance becomes a mechanism of governance that they have to use in order to get things done.
And when I studied the Cultural Revolution in China, I actually came across similar conclusions that it was the lack of coordination that actually is what ran the death toll up.
And also, too, like take collectivization, for example. You know, they're sending out workers and they're sending out young people. These young or very earnest young communists are being sent out to villages to, and they're told to collectivize agriculture. Think about how much power they're giving 18 and 19 year olds to carry out regime policies. I mean, this is the thing, like one of the aspects of the Stalinist state, particularly in the early years, it's incredibly mobilizational. Or even during the terror, where, you know, workers are denounce their bosses. I mean, think about what it would be like to be able to denounce your boss. And this causes a lot of the bloodletting and carnage and cannibalism of the period.
You know, a lot of people focus on the main organ of the party in the USSR, but your focus has been at least as much, if not more, on like periphery groups like the Komsomol groups.
Mm-hmm.
If you were trying to get contemporary, say, left groups to understand how communists actually worked, how would you say these para-party orgs, which often were directly organized through the party or into the party, actually functioned? Because they did mm-hmm. have some kind of independence, even during the Stalin period.
Oh, yeah. They had lots of independence just by virtue of the communication delays. You know, a party secretary can do all sorts of things today. And Moscow, if it actually ever does hear about it, won't hear about it for several weeks. So, you know, you could – it's really hard to describe, because what you – tended, and this was a constant frustration on the part of the center, is you have a tendency for the formation of clan and patron client networks on the local level. So, for example, you would and it's important to note that a lot of these conditions are not only replicated up the food chain, but are allowed to exist by virtue of the system Stalin created. And these patron client networks at the local level can either act as a pushback to central directives. They can act as circles of corruption. They, in some cases, these guys can be little mini Stalins with their own ballywicks. Sometimes they're in league with the local police organs. They use these mechanisms to dispose of and get rid of their political rivals and enemies on the local level. And what the center has to do in some cases is actually send out its own they're called responsible instructors out to like localities to do reports and observe what's going on. Usually sometimes what happens is, and there's some scandals in the late 20s and early 30s around this, where one of these guys from Moscow comes to a local, you know, organization and they're wined and dined, given prostitutes and things like this. And of course they go back and they report that everything's fine back there. So there is a lot of corruption going on, but it's also, again, conditions in which the Stalinist system created, because the center is putting so much pressure for local activists and secretaries to produce results that they have to engage in all of these mechanisms to get by. Or the fact of the strengthening of party secretaries from the center that allows them to dispose of, say, you know, Trotskyists or Bukharinists, whether these people are any of those things.
One of the most fascinating things I have found about reading Stalin, which is kind of an odd habit that I've developed over the course of my life, is that I remember, like, when I was in high school, and I am just barely... I'm a zennial, right? I remember the Cold War only in memories of 5 to 11 years old. So mm-hmm. it was a thing, but it's a vague, hazy memory. But I remember when I was in high school, you know, you'd read like Pipes, you'd read, various very conservative...
Robert Conquest.
Conquest, yeah. Narratives about Stalin. And they would even go so far as to implicate him in like having Kirov murdered and stuff like that.
Right.
Having actually read Stalin, I don't see any evidence that he didn't believe 90% of what he said.
Well, that's the thing. There's a collection of Stalin's letters to Molotov, edited by a very good historian, Lars Lee. He's done some, his recent work is on Lenin, which is I highly recommend.
Yeah, I have his book on Lenin right beside me.
Yeah. Lars says something that's in the introduction to that Stalin-Molotov letters collection, where he says, you know, we would have all benefited if Stalin was a bit cynical. He was a true believer. And what the archives have revealed to us is that they talked the same way behind the closed doors as they did publicly in many respects. They used the same types of categories and concepts to understand Soviet society. And, you know, in their own internal documents, Stalin was a true believer, so much so that I think this is why, you know, violence was such an easy thing to use, because he believed that and his people believed that they were reshaping, you know, humanity. So I think in that sense, the, you know, to give some credence to, say, somebody like Richard Pipes or Robert Conquest, I mean, the ideology was important, but it's also important to understand that they dealt they were trying to deal with real problems in a country that, for all intents and purposes, between 1914 to 1922 was destroyed. I think a lot of our understandings of the Soviet system, I think we forget that Russia, the Russian Empire, was in continual crisis from 1905 to 1922. That's a very long period of social unrest, political violence, terrorism. I mean, I was teaching a class on the Russian Revolutionary Movement in the spring, where the numbers of victims to terrorist attacks from 1905 to, I think, 1914 was in the tens of thousands, was like 17,000, I think. So we have to remember that the prehistory of the Bolshevik Revolution, let alone the formation of the Soviet state, is in a context of a country that has been utterly kind of devastated.
This brings me to one of the more fascinating things I hear asserted now, and it's going to seem irrelevant at first, and then maybe I can try to make it a little bit more relevant. There's a lot of talk about how Russia has been re-Orthodox Christianized.
Mm-hmm.
I used to believe this too, but I found it very interesting because if you go to like most of the other periphery Soviet states, a certain amount of atheism is still very given. I mean, I'm thinking of like the Czech Republic. And yet also a lot of people didn't understand even Stalinist policy towards religion, because there's a focus on its suppression, which was real.
Yes. But
one, is the murderous religiosity now as profound as people think it is? And two, was there actually a suppression as profound as people think it was either?
The present day issue of religion is a really interesting one, and I think a lot more kind of study needs to be done, because it is often asserted that there is an Orthodox religious revival. The trouble with that is that ethnic Russians see Orthodoxy as a point of identification, as almost an identity, not so much as, say, as a believer. I mean, certainly they'll believe in God, but church attendance is rather low in today's Russia. I think the figure that's bandied about is about 3%, which is very low church attendance.
That's like Russia, that's Western Europe level church attendance.
Yeah, though you do have a lot of various practices like pilgrimages, going to holy sites, certainly engaging in rituals around holidays, you know, just like here in the United States, more people go to church around holidays, religious holidays, certainly the practice of baptism and things like this. There is a church presence in those kind of life, you know, events. But does that mean there's a religious revival? I don't know. Because it depends on how you measure that in terms of people's religiosity and their practice in the church. So, and then even on the cultural level, if you look at like what's being broadcast on Russian television in terms of entertainment, the conservatism as a dish doesn't really exist in terms of popular culture. So it's hard to say. I mean, Russian society is conservative in terms of family structure, certainly towards homosexuality and other kind of behaviors that aren't within the norm. But I think the way Russians actually go about their lives is far less conservative than we assume. You know, if you look at like rates of adultery, for example, or divorce, for example. Now, in terms of religiosity in the Soviet system, there is a very good book recently published by Victoria Smolkin on atheism. It's called Sacred Space is Never Empty. And what she shows is that one of the problems that the Bolshevik regime had, on the one hand, it suppressed religion in the 1920s and early 1930s quite harshly. You know, closing of churches, various anti-religious camp propaganda campaigns, the arrests and some executions of priests, things like this. But religiosity continued because they could never successfully fill that vacuum of sacredness in people's lives. They couldn't form an atheist ideology that was more proactive than, say, an ideology of absence, you know, the absence of belief. And then also, too, religiosity, even in the pre-revolutionary period, was never fully institutionalized. If you read like accounts of priests, like how lay people viewed priests, priests were always viewed somewhat skeptically, as was the hierarchies of the church, the institutions of the church. So a lot of, you know, peasant, say, religious practice was, you know, very on the level of folklore, you know, rather than institutionalized within the church itself. So a lot of these practices persisted in the Soviet period. And once Stalin rehabilitates the church during the war, there is a gradual opening of churches, which I was surprised to learn that there's actually in the 1950s, particularly after Stalin's death, there's a more of an opening of churches and people are actually going to church. People are actually practicing baptism. It's only the rituals of, you know, birth, marriage, death are secularized. And I think what you get in actual practice is just a mixture of, you know, religious rituals with the kind of secular ones that the state tries to promote amongst the population. Though you do have and then in the 1970s, you get a similar, and Victoria talks about this, in the 1970s, you get a similar kind of crisis of religiosity in the Soviet Union that you find in the West, and where people are now experimenting with other forms of religiosity, whether it's like Hinduism or some sort of Eastern thought, or, you know, going back to kind of astrology, stuff like this. So it's, you know, the Soviet Union is very much part of the general trends of modern European life in the 20th century. And if there is an Orthodox revival today, it should be viewed not as something particularly Orthodox or about Russia, but viewed in terms of the general revival of religiosity all over the world.
This kind of brings me back to a question that has always fascinated me, that I've never had a good answer for. And I've never heard, this is another question I don't know that leftists often deal with. Why did so many cultural and even like very specific and weirdly cultural things in, say, Western Europe and America have parallels in the Soviet Union that seem to happen semi-organically? They weren't just from outside influence.
Like, for example?
I was just thinking about all the TV shows, for example.
Oh.
Are just like strange stuff like that. I'm also
like thinking, game shows.
Yeah, game shows. And
I was surprised to learn there were game shows in the Soviet Union. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, just stuff like that. I've been reading about that recently, and I didn't have a good answer for that. And I guess maybe the other thing was the importation of some Western ideas. I remember, like, in the Khrushchev period, there's a really strong interest in cybernetics as a way to...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. To, like, organize society. These parallels kept on popping up.
Right.
Was it just from exposure, or do you think there was, like, some kind of maybe, like, convergent evolution going on or something?
Well, some people argue that there was a certain level of convergence. I mean, this is one of the basis for détente in the 1960s and 70s, and that the Soviet Union and the United States, despite its different ideological positionings, were becoming, in a general sense, modern states and societies that tended to converge rather than diverge. I mean, I think what it is that the Soviet Union just never was as closed a society as we imagine it to be. there's a lot more cultural, cross-cultural exchange. I have a friend right now who is researching pioneer camps, the main one being the Artek camp in Crimea, where you had American children going to in the 1960s and 70s. I think there was a lot more cultural exchange, particularly with Europe, that I think historians are only now really giving more and more attention to. And I think it's, you know, it's not necessarily I think it's wrong to see it in terms of, you know, say Western influence and things like this. I just think it's part of the general kind of mass media spread of popular culture, or the globalization of popular culture that we see in the mid to late 20th century. And the Soviet Union is part of that, right? They are not going to, first off, they can't structurally close off all of this stuff. And there is something to be said of the general modernization of Soviet society that certainly, you know, isn't exactly a carbon copy of the West or America, but certainly has a lot of the same cultural practices that you find in all of these places.
I guess one of the key themes we're hitting on here is this: is both Russia and the Soviet Union way more different than we think, but also not as different as we think. Which,
yeah.
Which seems like you're not saying anything, but I mean, I think it's kind of profound in some ways that we keep on trying to read political institutions in particular as if they are like ours, and were ever like ours.
Right.
But we also tend to somehow think that Soviet cultural space is utterly alien. And thus, modern Russian cultural space is treated as somehow utterly alien too, even though I can't imagine that. I just
today Russian cultural space. I mean, there's always a certain Russian flavor, but in all honesty, they have all the same shit over there as we do here. Right. You know, in terms of, you know, when a new superhero movie comes out, some like Iron Man comes out, for example, it's big over there just like it is over here. So they're part of, again, they're part of a globalization of popular culture, of mass media. And in some cases, you know, certain segments of the Russian population are far more in tune with those cultural products than say than we are with theirs. And I think this is one of the funny things I find about all of this hysteria about Russian bots and trolls and fake news and all of this stuff. I mean, my God, there's nothing the Russians can produce that will ever be more powerful than Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, the ideological values and narratives in Hollywood movies are far more powerful than anything the Russians could produce. You know, and of course that causes a lot of anxiety in Russia, right? Because then they think their culture is being diluted and things like this, particularly amongst conservatives and the more nationalist types. And this is not to say that, you know, it is this everything here and there is the same. But there is more parallels. And in the Soviet system, the space of articulation was far narrower than you could in the West by any, you know, imagination, because of the ideological controls. But what that produces is just more subtle ways to say certain things in art and culture and film that Soviet audiences would understand, but not necessarily say translate to, you know, us, that we would note.
I always think about, because like many Westerners, my favorite Russian filmmaker is the one I know, and that's Tarkovsky.
Yes.
But I've always been fascinated by what he got made and what it projected. Because the more I've studied Russian history and Soviet history, the more I'm actually like, they let that through?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, no, it is sometimes baffling. Like, what they didn't, they, why did they let that through? And I think the reason why we're surprised is because we assumed that these censors also were competent.
Yeah.
You know, and I find this in my classes all the time. There's a kind of assumption that people who lived in the Soviet Union were far more politically conscious than anywhere else in other spaces and other historical eras. Like, you know, how did they deal with the fact that they didn't have freedom of speech? Well, a lot of people just didn't care because they go about their lives, right? They're not concerned with the kind of large political issues that may occupy you or me. But, you know, people go about their daily lives. Most people in all societies are more concerned about their friends and family and going about their daily life and not really about the big political, social, cultural questions that govern the day.
Yeah. From my own experience, I realized that pretty profoundly when living in Egypt.
Exactly.
Because, you know, we were under a military democracy, in quotation marks. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I was even there when they reinstituted the 49-day, you know, martial law that will probably last for another 50 years. But it didn't change daily life that much at all. Like, you know, in fact, talking to people who lived through the Egyptian Revolution and the counter-revolutions, they would say, like, most people weren't that affected, even when there wasn't a government period, which to American minds sounds insane. Like, we're just like, huh?
But, you know, yeah, and of course, you know, what needs to be said because of the charged ideologies around this thing is that this doesn't make this that, you know, the Putin system or the Soviet system or the Stalin system, whatever, inherently good. It just is what it is. And my one of my things about, say, understanding today's Russia is try to understand the Russia we have rather than the Russia we want.
I'm going to end on this question, but this one's a little bit big. So just a heads up. But this is my final question for you. Understanding that a lot of Americans don't even view the fall of the Soviet Union as a tragedy, how traumatic is that experience still on the Russian consciousness? And maybe spell out a little bit why it was so traumatic for so many people. I mean, I don't think people grasp the numbers of, like, say, men who just disappeared or died, like, for whatever reason.
I think that the trauma of the collapse is fading just because of generational difference, right?
You have a generation now, essentially.
Right? Yeah, you have a whole generation that was born under the new system, so they don't have the same orientation. But it's certainly the trauma of the collapse continues to be utilized by the Putin regime. But I even wonder how more effective it is. So what the Putin system does is says, look, a rapid revolutionary political change leads to chaos like the 1990s. And they'll use this for every kind of revolution throughout the world, the Arab Spring, Ukraine, whatever it is. Look what happens. Chaos, chaos, chaos. But I'm starting to wonder how a lot more Russians, particularly younger generation of Russians, orientation is not necessarily the 1990s. But the prosperity years of the 2000s, and that their expectations are increasingly different. So it's not about, say, the fear of going back to the chaotic 1990s, but the question of why aren't we still prosperous like in the 2000s, right? It's a different orientation. Because on the one hand, if you say the trauma of the 1990s, as the Putin regime likes to do, then that means, you know, this is why we should stay in power, because we rescued the country from the chaos of the 1990s. But if your orientation is, my memory is of the good times of the 2000s, and now the regime that was in power then and is still in power now, not producing that prosperity, well, maybe it's time for them to leave. Right. So it's a different, and this is what I wonder, and I haven't seen, you know, any kind of commentary or studies on this different perspective. But I do wonder that. But the collapse of the Soviet system was incredibly profoundly traumatic. You can think of it as kind of pulling the rug out from under a society. And this isn't to say that, you know, 1991 yesterday was profoundly different than tomorrow. It was a gradual change. I mean, people who lived through experience tend to date it around 1996 when Gorbachev started to institute some of the reforms. But I think, you know, again, back to what I said earlier, the loss of a set of values was profound in the sense of, you know, because the reaction against the Soviet system, communism, whatever it may have been, was so stark in the 1990s. That people were left disoriented because, look, I grew up under this old system and now they're telling me my life was, I was brainwashed or it's worthless now. And the question is, well, what are you supposed to do with that? You know, how do you change your identity? How do you refashion yourself in a situation where things are moving really rapidly, where I think it is a period of profound disorientation for a lot of people. And you can see this in some of the memoir literature. If you look at, you know, Svetlana Alexeyevich's Secondhand Time, you see a lot of this rhetoric. You see it in other books that talk about people's experience in the 1990s. And then if you add on the sheer collapse of the infrastructure, the outcomes in health, the shortening of life expectancy, the increase of crime, the increase of alcoholism, the exodus and brain drain of, you know, people who are able to leave and go to Israel or go to the United States or go to Western Europe. The other problem of, and Putin hits on this too every once in a while, the fact that if you're a ethnic Russian in Kazakhstan, for example, under the Soviet Union, you were a Soviet citizen. You are a citizen of the entire Soviet Union. After the collapse, now you live in Kazakhstan. So you're a citizen of the Kazakh state. So that also, you get a breakup of, you know, this kind of Russian diaspora as well. That, you know, Russians in the Baltic states, Russians in Moldova or in Ukraine or in Central Asia or in, for example, in Chechnya, where there used to be a million Russians living in Grozny. So there is a profound, I don't see how, I mean, Putin is often kind of ridiculed for this statement as a great, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union being the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century. But my God, so was the collapse of the Russian Empire in 1917, though so was the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. I mean, these were all geopolitical catastrophes that, I mean, take the Middle East, for example, we're still dealing with the legacies of that.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, we've been lucky that the collapse of the Soviet Union has been as neat as it has been for outsiders.
Honestly, I mean, if you compare the collapse of the Russian Empire to the collapse of the Soviet Union, I mean, any sane person will take the collapse of the Soviet Union over anything because, you know, forget about the Bolsheviks and all that stuff, but just the levels of displacement, violence, refugeedom, homelessness, mass slaughter, disease, epidemic. I could go down a long list.
Yeah, and my God, if you start looking at the end of the Ottoman Empire and living in Egypt and having spent significant time in Turkey, I can tell you it's still pretty much with us.
So the problem is that if you see the collapse of the Soviet Union as a trauma, right, or a catastrophe, then you have to say, wait a second, then perhaps there is. It kind of sours the victory of the Cold War, right? Sours. Then you have to try to understand Russians from their own perspective rather than seeing it as the 1990s as the potentials of democracy, liberalization, which was all there, of course. But, you know, there's a lot of other stuff going on. Then you have to understand the failure of democracy and liberalism taking root in Russia more in terms of the collapse and the continued collapsing of that system, not ending in 1991, but really throughout the 1990s, the system is repeatedly continuing to collapse.
Right. So it's not even like one thing. You have basically from 86 to maybe 1999 of just...
Yeah, I think the pivotal moment was the financial crisis of 1998.
That was a rough time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something that I just don't think people, because we have a very particular narrative about the Cold War. I mean,
right.
And in some ways, even the American far left does, even if it's just inverts it. Mm-hmm. The complicatedness of how long that was and how it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just 1991, Yeltsin, the end. I mean, the number of people who don't even know about Yeltsin and the tanks is...
Right, which the 25th anniversary was just, you know, I mean, the 20th anniversary was just this past week. That, yeah, the 25th anniversary, yes. Mm-hmm.
That gets me. I mean, you know, when Yeltsin, what is it, pulled the tanks up to the Duma, it's just like, people don't seem to think that's a big deal. Like, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, and also being supported, you know, bending over backwards by Bill Clinton supporting, and actually the internal government documents were released this past week, or at least I saw them referenced, where it has these conversations between Bill Clinton and Yeltsin and how Bill Clinton is giving his unconditional support to Yeltsin's bombardment of the Duma. And you know, this at this moment in 1993 is exactly what allowed us to have Mr. Putin today, institutionally, because Yeltsin was able to put forward a constitution that hobbled the parliament and created super presidency that Mr. Putin enjoys to this very day.
I will end it on the note of America is very good at creating its own nightmares.
and forgetting about them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. like I said, having spent a lot of time in East Asia and a fair amount of time in the Middle East. Oh, you were really good at it. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Do you have anything to plug other than Sean's Russia blog?
Yeah, just subscribe to my podcast, Sean's Russia blog. You can find it on all sorts of your podcast friendly apps and things like this. And if you're interested in the history and politics and culture of Eurasia, then tune in. I try to do a good job of trying to provide that story and all of its complexity and nuance.
There are really only two podcasts doing it. It's you and New Books in Eurasia. And that's pretty much it. And yours is usually more interesting to listen to.
Thanks.
So you have an endorsement from me, and thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.